They just weren't listening. He'd paced the streets of London door to door, tracking poor, emaciated faces. People he knew, people he cared for, and it was all pointing in the same direction. He'd found the link, even drawn them a map to show it, but still nothing. So now it was time to take action. If they weren't going to do anything about this growing terror, then he would. Mr. Snow! See here, Mr. Snow! He turned to find the man he'd posted at Broad Street, sprinting, half falling through the mud towards him. Mr. Snow, we're ready. We've got everything you need. John nodded, and followed the man back in the direction he'd come from. He had a new bounce in his step. This was it, the day they had to hear him. He'd rip off that water pump handle and then they'd see.
You've now joined us in the 19th century and in the sixth episode of our History of Pandemic season. Some say that the man you've just heard from plays a central role in the story we're about to tell. And some say that he was just one of many trying to tackle that century's foremost threat. Either way, that threat is one which you'll probably have heard of, not least because it's still around in our own time, cholera. So let's begin by finding out more about this devastating disease from our medical experts, Blanche Ogunti and Brian Angus.
Cholera is an acute diarrheal disease caused by intestinal infection with toxin-producing gram-negative bacterium Vibrio cholerae. So there are many serogroups of V. cholerae, but only two, O1 and O139, cause outbreaks. And currently, I think V. cholerae O1 has caused all the recent outbreaks.
And in fact, there's some evidence that the disease itself probably relates to the fact that the Vibrios pick up some extra genetic material that switches on some toxin production. So some people have argued that, in fact, epidemics of cholera are epidemics of this phage that invades the bacteria and causes the bacteria to become toxigenic and produce toxin. Cholera is very much is the archetypal toxin disease. It produces cholera toxin, which binds to the gut and causes the gut to secrete lots and lots of fluid. And so, again, I've seen patients with cholera working in Thailand, for example, and they just have massive diarrhea, and people die of shock, basically. They just lose huge amounts of volume. And so management of cholera really involves giving lots of fluid to people as soon as possible, usually intravenously. And then there's a little bit of a role for antibiotics, but that's really to stop it spreading from person to person. And again, this thing about it's a waterborne disease, it's very much related to drinking contaminated water. And it's very much a human-to-human through the water transmission.
Essentially, it's spread by eating or drinking food or water contaminated by the feces of infected persons, shedding Vibrio cholerae. That's not a great thought, is it? Though in low-resource environments with poor sewage facilities, this is the perfect environment which causes efficient spread of cholera. The typical at-risk areas are kind of peri-urban slums, camps for internally displaced persons or refugees, where there's only minimum requirements of clean water and sanitation, which aren't being met. The consequences of loads of humanitarian crises that cause, say, disruption of water and sanitation systems, displacement of populations, inadequate overcrowded camps. These are where you have your increased risk of cholera transmission because people are defecating out in the open and it's getting into the water systems, the drinking systems, and essentially provision of safe water and sanitation is critical to control the transmission of cholera and also other waterborne diseases. The hallmark of cholera is a kind of profuse watery diarrhea, and it's actually dehydration from the severe diarrhea, which is the most dangerous clinical feature.
Sanitation is really important for control of outbreaks of these sorts of waterborne diseases, particularly cholera and also things like typhoid.
That's the disease we're dealing with then. So let's find out how and when it emerged. Time to introduce my main guest for today, Dr. Klaas Kerschel, Oxford Martin Fellow from the Programme on Collective Responsibility for Infectious Disease.
The cholera pandemics of the 19th century are really the kind of big bang of international health. They kick off starting in 1817 to 1824 in the kind of Gulf of Bengal area. And cholera has been endemic there probably for a long time, but this time something's new and the disease spreads over large parts of the Indian subcontinent and is then also perceived to be spreading across Asia towards Europe. Initially, people aren't really aware that this is a new disease. They aren't really aware that this is something unique or special. And it's only very gradually in an age before there's any knowledge of microbiology whatsoever and lots of conflict about whether disease is caused by kind of climatic exhalations, humoral imbalance or filth, whether, or, you know, how one could even think of this disease. So historians have seen that during this period, there's a growth of temples being built dedicated to specific fever goddesses in the Indian subcontinent, and increasingly European colonial authorities and authorities of the East India Company start picking up that something's going on and they're sending reports back. So by the end of the 1817-1824 period, when there have been thousands of fatalities in these areas, there is an awareness that this was something new, and this fear of cholera, something new, something that is very dangerous, gets reinforced over subsequent pandemic waves. There are numerous pandemic waves of cholera during the 19th century. And so after this initial 1817-1824 event, subsequent pandemic waves really drive home this narrative that there is a danger of new kinds of disease spreading from parts of the world to other parts of the world. And in the European consciousness, often enough, you know, you get references to the Black Death, etc. But these cholera pandemics, they really spark a new kind of way of thinking about disease as something that connects distinct societies. Disease is something that is related to rapid travel. Disease is something that affects, obviously, European populations as well. That's very important for the imperial imaginary during this period. And as a consequence, it triggers, by 1851, faced with, again, new resurgent cholera pandemics, attempts by imperial authorities, here notably the French, British, Spanish, and also some other imperial authorities, to devise some kind of international framework of how to deal with it. I mean, similar to nowadays, a pandemic is a hugely disruptive event for trade. It causes fear, it causes social unrest and tensions. And so in 1851, there's really a consolidated international attempt to develop a legal framework to A, agree what cholera actually is. Remember, this is before you can see cholera under a microscope or, you know, do anything with it. And there's also a really big attempt to think about how to deal with quarantine. I mean, that's something that we're still thinking about with COVID-19. So how long is an appropriate quarantine? How should a port deal with ships with suspected cholera victims on board? How do you treat ships flying, you know, with under a different flag? So all of these things get debated. In a sign of the time, however, there's no definitive agreement reached on this. It's actually only in 1892 when microbiologists start coming in and, you know, showing you the pathogen causing cholera, and there's much more sophisticated understandings of how disease spreads, that new conventions are really reached that span larger parts of the globe.
But this wasn't, of course, the only outbreak of cholera in the 19th century.
There are a series of cholera pandemics that sweep around the world. So the first one is from 1817 to 1824. Then another one is from 1829 to 1837. Then another one from 1846 to 1860, from 1863 to 1875, and then from 1881 to 1896, and from 1899 to 1923. Now, these don't all hit England in the same way, or, you know, the British Isles, they don't hit Europe in the same way because of the global interconnectedness. There is really this awareness of cholera as a major challenge. And increasingly, the more it becomes associated as a kind of disease that is spread by filth, it becomes a sign of your civilatory but also moral progress by not having cholera incidents within your cities. And again, cholera is kind of the menace lurking in the shadow of people's mind when they authorize large-scale spending on sanitation and sewerage upgrades, which really start gathering steam in the UK from the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s onwards, where there's large-scale expenditure, and it really does result in a measurable decrease of the spread of waterborne pathogens.
I particularly wanted to focus in on England around the middle of the 19th century and ask Klaas to paint a picture of what public health was like in the country at this time.
The cholera pandemics hit England in a very unique point in time. So since the early 19th century, late 18th century, there have been quite big changes that have happened in terms of thinking about disease. Coming out of specifically France, there's this increasingly rigorous concept of disease as something that you can localize within your body. So since the 18th, 17th century, disease, older medieval notions of disease as a kind of imbalance of the body are being displaced by increasingly systematic pathological examinations of the body. And increasingly there's this notion, okay, we can localize disease in a specific point of the body. So disease is no longer something that just arises spontaneously, but there are distinct diseases and we can differentiate between them. And at the same time, there's this Enlightenment post-French revolutionary hope in a kind of rational reconstruction of societies and an increasing trust in maths. So people start counting deaths. Sounds not particularly revolutionary, but actually having robust data sets of deaths in specific localities that you can then analyze statistically. So, you know, the difference between an endemic disease and an epidemic is just really, you know, a kind of rise over what you would expect in the number of deaths occurring. These two changes start bringing in a kind of new way of conceptualizing disease. And there's a young generation of often quite radical medical doctors, public health doctors, who are starting to emphasize that states should take care of their citizens, that it is part of states' interest to boost the welfare of societies by taking specific forms of sanitary intervention further. So in the UK, there is a group of influential people surrounding, for example, Chadwick, who are using these statistics to press for sanitary reform. And cholera in this situation is almost, I shouldn't say godsend, but it definitely boosts the cause of these public health practitioners because it is such an explosive disease. It causes terror in the repeated waves of introduction in the UK during this period, and it boosts the political weight of the demands of public health reformers who can now successfully press for the case that some kind of sanitary reform is necessary. There may be disagreement about the cause of cholera, but it is increasingly linked to filth, stagnant water, specific forms of poverty, in the Victorian mind also specific forms of amoral behavior. So drunkards and, you know, people living squalid lifestyles are then blamed for contracting the disease because of their lacking morality there too. So it's kind of a comprehensive reform program of boosting health. Health defined here no longer as the health of the individual, but as of the population. And it really feeds into this new narrative of nation states, modern young nation states emerging during this period, who are concerned with boosting the efficiency of their population and also obviously preventing social unrest.
So that's the public health system. But I still wondered how the wider society reacted to this growing threat.
The cholera pandemics initially trigger moral panic. So large parts of the initial, how should I say, official communication that you read, it isn't really modern public health communication in a way, it combines national calls to prayer, begging for forgiveness, and other kind of spiritual interventions with suggestions like keeping clean, being moderate in your diet, so again, to not kind of affect your constitution, not drinking to excess, washing your hands. So it's kind of a potpourri of different recommendations of kind of tried and trusted 18th, 19th century attempts to curb disease. There's also a flourishing market of private preventative measures. And as the 19th century progresses, this becomes ever more colorful with kind of new concepts of germ theory intermingling with older concepts of miasmatic theory. So you'll get people advertising carbolic acid as a kind of disinfection that you can use internally and externally. You'll have rose petal dust because of its great smell dispersing cholera germs. In our typhoid exhibition, we had a great example of people simultaneously advertising hair lotion to restore hair, which allegedly falls out when you suffer from cholera or typhoid, and cure you of the cholera at the same time. So there's a huge variety of medical interventions. But what does seem to be an emerging consensus within the emerging public health discipline of the time is that sanitary interventions seem to offer a good chance of prevention, regardless of whether you agree in germ theory or you agree in miasma or, you know, other forms of kind of contagionism. You will probably agree that getting rid of stagnant water, getting rid of exhalations and of filth achieves a kind of common goal.
This seemed like a good time to bring into the story that physician called John Snow, along with his famous water pump moment. I'm aware from my own research that such historical narratives can be misleading. giving the false impression, with hindsight, that the line of progress suddenly became clear after some crucial experiment or insight, such as Galileo's falling cannonballs or Newton's falling apple.
I think in general, it's wrong to think of knowledge progressing inevitably to a certain point. And if you're looking back at history, there's always a temptation to always, yell at your source and say, isn't it obvious? Why can't you see this? And it ends up with you asking wrong questions. It ends up with you, in the kind of jargon we say, creating a tautology where, progress is inevitable. If only people had followed John Snow at the time, everything would have been clear. John Snow is one of a number of physicians during this time employing maths, employing statistics, and employing epidemiological, really kind of leather shoe epidemiology to trace the origins of outbreaks. And he's a physician in London during this period and becomes concerned about cholera spreading in London. And he starts investigating, going to the households, asking, where water has been taken from, and also asking numerous other questions. And he links of claims that he has found a link. Again, this is before you have any kind of microbiological proof that what he's claiming is actually true, that cholera outbreaks are linked to this one pump to this one water company supplying water. He then creates a map, which is specifically designed to prove his point. So the map is less a piece of rigorous science, as we often now kind of retrospectively claim it to be, and more kind of political statement. It does blend out specific points of information that you wouldn't blend out nowadays to, really drive home the point he is hoping to make. And at the end of the cholera outbreak is really dying down at the end of this, then spectacularly removes the handle of the Broad Street pump.
John Snow mapped where the cases were, basic epidemiology, looked at the risk factors. This is what we do with any outbreak is we try and make a case definition of what the disease is, and then we will look at people who meet that case definition, and then we'll ask them lots of questions about what they did and who they've been in contact with and where they've been and what they've been doing. And he tracked it down that there was a common water source that these people were using. And he tried to get it shut down and didn't manage, and so took matters into his own hands and took away the pump handle and reduced the cholera transmission.
In removing it, he kind of starts setting a precedent for, thinking of cholera as something that is water-related. Snow isn't that prominent during his time. And this is not because, there's some kind of evil conspiracy going on against epidemiology during this period. It's because there are very plausible alternative, according to the current state of science, knowledge, competing theories of disease ongoing. Snow is writing again during this time period when there seems to be very plausible evidence that disease is also spread via specific climatic variations. So there and also very lots of hybrid theories circulating. So for example, one of Oxford's most famous physicians during this period, Sir Henry Acland, who later becomes the Regius Professor of Medicine in Oxford, he investigates Oxford's cholera outbreaks. And in the 1850s, he publishes another looks almost identical to Snow's map, goes from house to house, gathers the case reports, produces this beautifully colored map of Oxford with different slum districts colored in. And when I show it to my students with modern medics, they say, oh, this is Snow. It's clearly bacteriological thinking linking to the water. But then you look in closer and you actually see that he's drawn in altitude lines. So what he's saying here is, yes, water may be a factor, but actually it's specific climatic conditions that also then kind of allow dangerous, poisonous vapors or toxic vapors to stay in specific areas that are not as present at higher levels. So it's a time of great competition between different theories of disease. So Snow he makes an interesting point. It is not conclusive evidence, not even by the standards of the time, that that is really the cause of the cholera pandemics. He is, however, later in the early 20th century, put on a pedestal by this rapidly establishing group of public health practitioners at universities who, see him as the founding father. And as with lots of founding myths, you have lots of heroic narratives arising around him. And, I research a lot of antibiotics. I could tell you a lot of stuff about Alexander Fleming, too, in this context.
But to sum up Snow's place in this narrative, I still felt that we could legitimately consider him to have played an important role in the history of epidemiology.
So yeah, Snow's really important. He is one of the first to really highlight waterborne connections. His epidemiological method is rigorous according to the current standards. However, it is not as, you know, it, according to the scientific knowledge of the time, it is not a conclusive proof. And it is more of an outlier theory in contrast to other more established theories like the one Ackland is proposing in Oxford, which often presume a kind of hybrid between contagionist and anti-contagionist causes. The modern notion of the scientist we now have emerges during the 19th century, but you cannot compare John Snow to a modern scientist. And the way modern science is conducted, the biomedical sciences, as we now know, this fusion of the biological and the medical sciences, that does not exist when Snow is doing these investigations. A large part of science in the 19th century is carried out by people we would perhaps now characterize as amateurs and seemingly individual investigators, although very well-networked ones, and often enough is relying on considerable sources of wealth, either privately or from other sources, to conduct these investigations. The modern notion of the kind of biomedical scientist we have now, that emerges as a result of the bacteriological revolution, but also the revolution of industry and the biomedical sciences and the kind of state interest in that that accompanies that. Perhaps it also makes it easier for us to envision these people, you know, as these almost Sherlock Holmes-like people, you know, with the hunch, and then, you know, he wanders London and finds the Broad Street handle and takes it off. I think it both allows us to romanticize in some way the work, and I think actually take the actual practice of doing this work less seriously, and also underestimate how revolutionary this was, how radical it was. Perhaps that's the better word for it. In the 19th century, Snow was an outlier initially, and the consensus that his theory was right emerged gradually. But there is this tendency nowadays to mistake the way he mobilized evidence with our way of mobilizing evidence, and then to presume that society should have automatically snapped their finger and seen, oh, this is what's causing the disease. He's a good retrospective hero.
If there were a number of key figures around at this time, I was keen to understand from class who else was contributing significantly to the understanding of this disease.
Well, as a German, I have to say Robert Koch, right? You know, he is the person to isolate the Vibrio, right? And his investigations in Hamburg, even though there's still a lot of contestation during this period, whether something is germ-borne or not, his new mode of presenting evidence, the kind of, even though he actually doesn't invent it, but it goes back to his student Friedrich Loeffler, the Koch's postulates, you know, of linking a microbe to a disease in a way that we probably wouldn't do anymore. But, you know, that kind of new way of mobilizing evidence, using the laboratory to make decisive claims about this is the disease, this is how it spreads, the disease is the pathogen, rather than the kind of wider climatic constitution and the in individual's constitution. That is what makes a huge difference. And in 1892, the time when those first sanitary conventions are reached, that is also the year when he in Hamburg has a major breakthrough in terms of cholera prevention during an epidemic that occurs in Hamburg. So British bacteriology in the 19th century also has lots of, you know, heroic figures. But if you really want to see how germ theory takes off, you have to look to the European continent, to the labs of Pasteur and to the kind of Kochian school of bacteriology, both of whom go on to dominate international bacteriology up until the First World War.
And Koch also found himself challenged by competing theories about the nature of this disease.
A very famous story of Koch is there's a very famous competition with Max Pettenkofer, who was a very famous advocate of sanitary theory, again, thinking that ventilation was a key driver of public health. And he famously trying to disprove Koch, and actually it's a successful challenge trial for him. He drinks a solution of cholera bacteria and doesn't fall ill, allowing him to claim that cholera clearly can't be proved by a germ. I mean, there are these scientific rivalries during the period, the way also people like Pasteur mobilize evidence is very selective. We shouldn't mistake it with the way, for example, clinical evidence is evaluated nowadays. It's often much less rigorous. The way statistics is used is very different. This is before really modern biostatistics emerged. They emerged towards the end of the 19th century, it's a different world. It's a different world again, in which, you know, you can have this outsized reputation of, you know, being this individual genius walking around. There is obviously a large associated body of other people gathering evidence during this period. I would say actually much more important than John Snow is the work of William Farr in the General Office of Statistics in Britain, just by compiling mortality reports, which gives people an increasing body of evidence to draw on when it comes to epidemiological analysis that is also then increasingly powerful when the maths becomes better towards the end of the 19th century in elucidating where disease comes from and also showing which interventions may be effective or not. There is a large kind of underbody of other people working in this area. It's very contested. Other people mobilize miasmatic theory using just the same numbers, just like Henry Acland did. He's later convert to bacteriology in Oxford, but in the 1860s, 1870s, he is convinced it's poisons. Oxford's medical officer of health up until 1902 does not believe in germs. He believes in poisons. It's a political choice on my behalf whether I say bacteriological revolution or not. It's a slow burning thing, right? So there are changes to the way disease is understood, but they filter unevenly through the scientific and medical establishment. They filter even more unevenly through popular knowledge. And this means that what we usually end up being confronted with is a very hybrid world, a world consisting of medical pluralism with older traditions of sense-making existing next to modern traditions of sense-making. There are fierce rivalries going on at the same time, and often enough, you only really realize that something is happening at a specific point 20 years into the future when you look back retrospectively. It's not obvious necessarily that things are going on in the moment.
Another thing I was keen to know more about, partly in the light of our modern experience of COVID, was to what extent certain groups or nations were blamed for the spread of cholera in 19th century England.
A disease is always politicized. I mean, think of cholera, the Asian cholera as it is then labeled. It comes with all kinds of racist assumptions against the supposed causes, this notion of sanitation as a civilatory achievement. I mean, the language of that, the justification it also gives you to intervene in other people's lives. There's a great global history called A History of Global Health Interventions into the Lives of Other People. Because disease is a social phenomenon, because it affects humans, it goes through our bodies, we shape its environment, we take the drugs, etc. A disease is necessarily a political entity. And I'm also very skeptical at the moment of calls to take the politics out of science that you often read on academic Twitter now, because the first thing people should have learned about the history of pandemics is that you cannot divorce science from politics, and that good science in this context is science that is politically aware and manages to navigate the political streams rather than say we are completely apolitical, don't touch us. I think that's the wrong ivory tower notion of science that never existed, and I think we never will exist in this context.
It was time to move to the end of the century and start to understand how countries began to get this disease under control.
Sanitary infrastructures which are put in place in the 19th century play an absolutely crucial role in reducing cholera and typhoid incidence. Now, for example, typhoid, you can also contract by contaminated food. Cholera can also be transmitted via other kind of roads of fecal exposure, etc. So this kind of mass societal susceptibility to explosive spreads of waterborne disease that we still see in low and middle income countries around the world, that goes down as a result of the quote unquote sanitary revolution during the period. And also the development of vaccines, which play an increasing role in protecting European troops abroad, and increasingly play a role in kind of stopping travelers from re-importing disease.
But sadly, unlike smallpox, cholera has not been eradicated.
Cholera is still an ongoing pandemic, one could almost say. So there is the classic cholera pandemics that sweep around the world in the 19th century. Those classic types get supplanted from 1961 by a new cholera type called El Tor, And between 1961 and 1975, there's this really sweeping around the globe of a new L2R pandemic strain. Again, you know, now clearly weighted towards areas of the world where water and sanitation and hygiene systems wash in the kind of professional speak are absent or insufficient. So that starts sweeping around the world. And in the early 1990s, there's actually global panic about the introduction of these strains into South America. You still have regular reports of outbreaks in Yemen, for example. Africa, African countries have reported outbreaks such as Zimbabwe in the 2000s. And there have been also reported cases in Asian countries too.
There are currently three WHO pre-qualified cholera vaccines that are around. They don't always get to the right places because obviously, as we've talked about, cholera tends to have outbreaks in places where there are disruptions in the political and social systems. You can then treat severe cholera with intravenous fluids or antibiotics, but mass administration of antibiotics isn't recommended because there's no proven effect that it really helps with the spread of cholera. It can reduce the duration of diarrhea if someone has it, but having mass administration of the antibiotics could contribute to antimicrobial resistance. There's always a fear during humanitarian crises, which are set in floods, flooded areas, that the dead bodies that are floating in the water can spread the cholera. But actually, there's no evidence that uninfected dead bodies can spread cholera, which is quite important to know.
All of this was hugely concerning, and I wondered out loud to class whether the cholera pandemic had ever really ended.
So in a way, we are still in the middle of a pandemic. And I think the interesting question to ask here about a pandemic is, what's the appropriate timescale to think of a pandemic? That's the historian's question, I think, in this regard. Coronavirus, COVID-19, makes everything seem very explosive, right? But my work on antimicrobial resistance, for example, you do start asking yourself the question, so when do we start speaking about a pandemic just because the timescale may be slightly off? In a way, we are seeing a slowly emerging rise of a completely new cast of very difficult to treat bacterial organisms sharing the same genetic elements that are spreading around the world. And so clearly this is also a temporal question that we have to ask ourselves. And we're clearly as humans geared towards prioritizing explosive events, the immediacy of action also in our political systems. But as cases like cholera or, you know, antimicrobial resistance show, there are very slow burning or, you know, comparatively slow burning outbreaks that span borders that are still ongoing and that are just as dangerous as COVID-19.
Pandemics can also lead to significant longer-term change, as Klaas outlined.
Pandemic events, the ones that we remember from the 19th century onwards, are usually associated with some kind of change to global governance with regard to international health. So the third plague pandemic, which starts in the late 19th century, or actually starts in the middle 19th century and then becomes a global problem in the late 19th century, triggers additional safeguards for ports, such as rat shields that we still use on ships, for example, to prevent rats from kind of jumping on ships and then popping up somewhere else in the world. We see the same happening with experiences of the so-called Asian flu, Hong Kong flu, leading to upgrades and changes of international sanitary arrangements or international health regulations. So there is a long history of linking pandemic events to often quite old and long-standing demands for changes to regulations, which are then implemented after a pandemic. So with COVID-19, I wouldn't be surprised if after this we see changes in the way reporting requirements for countries are stipulated. We saw a big change of that already in 2005 after the 2003 SARS outbreak. I think another thing we may see, and this is pure speculation on my part, historians are notoriously bad at predicting the future, we'll probably also see a formalization of some of the emergency licensing mechanisms that we've seen for new diagnostics, vaccines, the information sharing of the scientific community, which has, I mean, it was already very impressive in 2009 and 2003 during preceding pandemics, but the scale at which we see this now is so unprecedented that I think we'll probably see some kind of formalization of that being put into place after this. But again, this is pure speculation. Historians are not good at predicting the future.
Just before our conversation ended, I was curious to what extent class felt a society's collective memory was impacted by the experience of a pandemic.
So, I mean, prevailing notions of disease are obviously already a result of existing cultural traditions of thinking about health and disease, but experiences of explosive disease outbreaks usually end up having some kind of effect within collective memory. But this varies, so it's very difficult to predict what kind of aspect of memory will end up taking hold. What we can say is that there has been a massive shift in how we as a society, as a global society, think about disease in terms of just thinking of them as microbes following the 19th century shift of laboratory medicine, which is, if you actually think about it, is pretty profound. The way we interact with surfaces, the way we structure food protocols, the way our mannerisms have changed. I'm not sure how long these things last, how long anything will last after COVID-19, after this experience there. It's very difficult to predict how a pandemic event is incorporated into a society's institutional memory. It's often speculated why, for example, the 1918 to 1920 Spanish flu didn't seem to have left more imprints on collective memory. And there's lots of competing explanations, for example, that the First World War, which was obviously also another very, very important global event that was going on at the same time, at the end of the day, probably overshadowed some forms of societal memories of it. So it's difficult to say. I think it's very difficult to generalize from one pandemic event to the other. I might speculate that perhaps face masks will become more a more accustomed sight in Western culture than they were before. But that's kind of as far as I will lean out of the window.
Next time on Future Makers, you'll meet the first of two influenza pandemics that we'll be covering, the so-called Russian flu. This is perhaps our most controversial selection of the series. Many would argue that other diseases, like typhoid, have had a far greater impact on human history. Others, that this wasn't even a pandemic, more a localized flu outbreak. And some recent studies hint that this might not have been a flu at all, but a strain of coronavirus. See what you think after joining me for our next episode in our History of Pandemics season. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.
Future Makers was created in-house at the University of Oxford and presented by Professor Peter Milliken from Hertford College. Our voice actor today was Ben Morrill, and the series is written and produced by Steve Pritchard and Ben Harwood. The score for the series was designed and created by me, Richard Watts. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you on behalf of the whole team for listening to the History of Pandemics.